Well, good evening and welcome to the Insight Hour. I'm Dr. Len Horowitz.
And I'm Sherry Kane.
And we come to you on BBS Radio every Tuesday night. It's a happy new day for you folks on the East Coast and 9 o'clock Pacific. We're here in Hawaii at 6 p.m. And gee whiz, Sherry, it's been, another great week. We've had a lot of wonderful things happen. Before we tell you about it and introduce our special guest tonight, let's thank our sponsors for tonight, besides Asheville Magazine. Thanks for Asheville's support for bringing you news features regarding holistic health and health sciences, that articles in metaphysics as well. Asheville is one of the leaders in that area. So AshevilleMagazine.com, thank you.
Yes, and we want to thank HealthyWorldStore.com for your amazing, amazing products, keeping people healthy throughout the year, especially OxySilver. And if you haven't tried Liquid Dennis, definitely try both of those products. They're amazing. Also, if you want to partner with us, join HealthyWorldAffiliates.com. And we also have a radio station now and a record company, 528records.com, where you can transpose your music into the 528 frequency of love and healing, and also our radio site, which is 528radio.com. Now, if you are a musician, you can upload your music to 528records.com, and we are the only record company that does this. We offer 60% royalties anybody who donates for your music. So it becomes part of our music library, so you get heard out there and your music is actually transposed into the 528 frequency of love. That is remastered automatically on the spot, and everybody can listen to your music. You won't actually hear a difference, but you'll feel a difference, and it's an amazing one.
Well, that's great. Yeah, that's most important too for musicians out there who are making wonderful works. I mean, you get ripped off like every major industry is a ripoff. Our guest tonight is going to be sharing a little bit about that from some pretty intense intelligence background and research investigations that he's conducted.
Right.
The music industry, I think, though, that one of the benefits I want to emphasize is that the remastering, of course, it's your work as an artist, it's your copyright material, and that the blessing is that we remaster it for you at no charge, so that you then have a brand new virtual album that is associated with the generating the 528 frequency, which is associated with the reason grass is green. The botanical world celebrates that love frequency, greenish yellow. It's a heart chakra energy, and it's really a magnificent resonance frequency for bringing about miracles. In fact, it is the original Mi note in the solfeggio musical scale. It's do, re, mi, stands for miracles, mira gestorum in Latin and miracles in English. And so the power of 528, the powerful 528 love revolution that's now advancing, snowballing in the music industry. And we're very, very humbled and thankful for being able to bring you 528 Radio Network. And there are up on that station right now, 528radio.com, there are now seven stations that are broadcasting in various genres, and will be, I pray, soon adding the eighth. So, Sherry, why don't you introduce our wonderful guest for tonight?
Well, our guest tonight is Michael Levine. He is the New York Times best-selling author of Deep Cover and one of the DEA's most decorated undercover agents. And he transferred into the DEA headquarters from his post in Buenos Aires and assigned to pose as the lover of Sonia Atalia, the breathtakingly beautiful woman named the Queen of Cocaine by Pablo Escobar. It was the dream undercover assignment turned nightmare that would blow the lid off of the CIA's sabotage of the drug war. Now, Michael Levine is a great, amazing author, and he's very, very well known all over the world. He's going to talk tonight about The Big White Lie, and he's also going to talk about Deep Cover and his work as an undercover DEA agent. And also, we're going to be exposing the CIA like we love to do on this
all
show.
All the time, yes.
Yeah,
so, Michael, welcome. It's like should be home for you.
Well, I'm happy to be there, although I'm not there. I wish I was. I'm in, it's midnight here in New York, but I'm living vicariously through my imagination.
Yeah, well, we'll spare some sunshine, some package it, and send it in the mail to you.
Great.
Yeah, so this background that you bring is extremely interesting to us, and we're actually living it. I'd like to just share a little bit what we're involved in, and then have you give some background on yourself,
sure,
as well as what you're doing currently to expose the issues with the intelligence community and how it's been undermined by agents that are not particularly blessing we the people. So,
yeah,
the local issue here is we're actually exposing a lot of high-level corruption. And one of the agents is his son. You might remember the CIA's Dr. Stanley Krippner. Remember that name?
That's not a name I remember. And I know, you know, we as a DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, deep cover agent, it's a little different than undercover. I had the experience of working pretty much around the globe, posing as a drug trafficker, and in general, going a lot farther than our government wanted me to go. You know, I, for some reason, bad guys trusted me. I'm bilingual. I speak fluent Spanish, and I pick up languages easy. I don't know why. It just is. And actually started out as a street narcotic agent in New York with a brother who was a heroin addict and, you know, very much a believer in the whole notion of a war on drugs. In fact, early in my career, you might have called me a kamikaze. I was just reckless with my life and, you know, and just believing I was a warrior on the right side, all of that stuff. I know there's a lot of people out there listening to me and cringing, but there are people like me out there. And a lot of us, or a lot of them, and a lot of guys and the people I knew who were in the same business are dead now. And I consider myself hugely lucky to be where I am. And but it started out with working the streets of New York. I grew up in the Bronx, the South Bronx. And working as an undercover agent, I learned the business, buying nickel bags, dime bags, buying cocaine on the street, and learning the business to the extent that I was able to work my way up to kilo dealers and multi-kilo dealers, and then work cases, arrest them, and as we say, flip them, and get them to introduce me to their sources. And eventually that led to my first real international case, and that was during the Vietnam War. I was at the airport at JFK on the Hard Narcotics Smuggling Unit and arrested a guy by the name of John Edward Davidson, and he had 3 kilos. He was an ex-GI who was traveling back and forth between Bangkok and the United States, and I actually caught him on his 7th trip. And he had 3 kilos of pure heroin in a false bottom suitcase. And John flipped, as we say, and agreed to work for me. And that night, we were on a plane to Gainesville, Florida, to deliver the 3 kilos of heroin to the financier of the operation. And his name was Alan Trupkin. And we arrested him and another fellow. And it looked like a great case for us. In those years, this was great stuff. I was very much into going after heroin dealers. The story I'm telling you is going to lead to my first crash with Central Intelligence. I asked John, I said, look, basically, my friend, you're facing 30 years in prison, but I can help you. Can you introduce me to your source in Thailand, in Bangkok? And he agreed to do that. And I'll cut the story very short. At the time, we were the Hard Narcotics Smuggling Unit of Customs, where I was an agent, was at a war with the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, and that war was for turf. So we both had offices in Bangkok. And we had a couple of other issues, too. We had an extremely corrupt police, and the Vietnam War was raging, so I did my first deep cover assignment went into Thailand with a fake passport, a fake ID, a fake everything, and basically was on my own. I couldn't carry a gun. All I could do was act to keep myself alive, and that's deep cover. You're totally away. It's not like an undercover. For comparison, an undercover case would be if I'm at the old DEA headquarters at 57th Street, and an informant says, you know, I've got a guy who'll sell you dope, and you're undercover for 10 or 15 minutes making the buy or arresting him, and then it's over. Now, deep cover, you live with these people. So I was totally unprepared for what was about to happen to me. We, being at war with the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, we couldn't tell them that I was there. So the only people that knew that I was in Bangkok meeting with heroin dealers were my bosses. And if something happened to me, I quickly realized that I was going to disappear, and probably no one would know what happened to me. It's a chilling. You're only a young man as I was, you know, the kind of young men that aren't afraid to go to war, that actually it's one of the reasons they make such good soldiers and fill body bags. Well, I was one of them. And getting to Thailand and on the street, the notion that I could die at any second, it was a kind of a turn-on, like a drug. I don't know if you understand that, and I don't know how many people can put themselves in my place, but I was totally turned on. At the same time, I believed I was doing God's work, and I was kind of thinking, you know, thank you, God, for putting me in this position, for letting me experience this. But I was pretty dumb. I had no idea what I was about to face. And I began living with two Chinese drug dealers in Bangkok. And they liked me. They trusted me. Nobody trusts you unless they first like you. So that's one of the rules of undercover work and deep cover work. You got to work on the like part of it. And they believed that I was, the capo di tutti frutti of the mafia. And they wanted to sell me much larger quantities of heroin than I had come to buy or I had come to arrange. And they said, you know, come to us up to Chiang Mai, and we want to introduce you to the factory. We want to introduce you. One of them, his uncle was running the factory where they were producing hundreds and hundreds of kilos of heroin, the same heroin that was going into the brain and veins of my brother, the same heroin that was going into the brain and veins of the GIs. And I thought, wow, this is great. So I contacted a fellow by the name of Joe Jenkins, who was the customs agent in charge, and we started to make arrangements for me to go to Chiang Mai. I'm suddenly called. I was staying at the Siam Intercontinental at the time, and I get called in the middle of the night, 2 or 3 in the morning, summoned into the embassy. Well, I have to go through the streets of Bangkok, making sure that no one's tailing me, walking several miles, doubling up and down blocks, and make it into the embassy. And there, I meet my first Central Intelligence agent. Well, he's something, I guess, you know, out of a Tom Clancy movie to me. I thought CIA, it would be many years before I started, I called them criminal inept agency because that's what they are. But at this particular time in my life, CIA was, I suppose, perceived the way a lot of people perceive CIA through what they see in the movies. And here was this man wearing a gun and the boots and a jungle shirt, and he said the following to me: "You're not going to Chiang Mai." And I said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Because we can't cover you up there." Well, I didn't even know they were covering me here. He said, "We can't be responsible for you, and we can't protect you." And I said, "But you don't have to protect me. I mean, I came this far with no one protecting me. I'm willing to go up there. This is a chance to identify where probably one of the biggest manufacturers of heroin on earth at this time. And when he saw he couldn't dissuade me, he said, you know, and I had just gotten out of the military. He said, you know, Levine, we got your record, and you're a military, you understand that you don't know the big picture. We want you to wrap this case up that you're doing now, arrest the people you met in Thailand, and just let it go with that. And I was a good soldier, and I believed what he said, and I believed that I didn't know the big picture. And we did that. I worked out a deal where the people I was hanging with in Bangkok delivered 1 kilo of heroin. That's all they wanted. At this point, they began to mistrust me because a lot of other things happened. All of this was, by the way, was written in a book about me that I hate. I hate to even mention the name of it. It's a book called Undercover by Donald Goddard. It's way out of print. It's a Random House book. It was written about my career while I was still a DEA agent. And it was written from the point of view of my ex-wife, so I don't think you want a book written about you from the point of view of one's ex-wife. But the whole story is there, to make sure that the book didn't get privished and disappeared, he left out the CIA part, and I'm telling your listeners it, or some of what happened afterward. The case goes down. We finally notify the Thai police that I'm there an hour before the drugs are to be delivered to me across the street from the Siam Intercontinental. We notify the Bureau of Narcotics at the last minute because being customs, we didn't even trust them. And the people are arrested. As a matter of fact, the Thai police were so shocked at the level of the people we were about to bust and the fact that these people were paying the Thai police that they didn't move. They weren't going to make the arrest. And a Bureau of Narcotics agent who later became a good friend, Tommy O'Grady, he went leaping across the street, this street that's pretty much the size of Times Square in New York, and he knocked the two drug dealers down. You know, this is, try and imagine a Thai cop in Times Square knocking you down and arresting you. That's about the equivalent, but that's the way it happened. And back in the U.S., I was able, they gave me a U.S. Treasury Special Act Award, I think the first case of its kind, where one undercover agent arrested the smuggler, the financier, and the source. Even though I knew it wasn't the ultimate source, we could have had him, but Central Intelligence stopped us. Well, back in the U.S., I was assigned with an ex-New York City detective who had become a customs agent to work another case. And we had an informant who was a GI in Vietnam and was heavily involved in smuggling heroin into the U.S. And I spent 2-3 days debriefing him, because I had spent 3 months in Bangkok, and I had acquired a lot of knowledge and a lot of intelligence about what was going on in the streets there. And I was astonished to realize, after debriefing this particular guy, that the people who were protected by Central Intelligence in Chiang Mai were the people who were the source of heroin coming into the U.S. in the bodies of our GIs. Now, it was hard for me to absorb that. I was still very young. And it was something that was so otherworldly, that I just kind of put it someplace in my subconscious and didn't really accept it. I don't know if you understand that. It was just too much for me. You know, having a brother who was a heroin addict, and then the concept of Central Intelligence protecting people who were putting drugs into the bodies of our GIs in Vietnam. You know, the man said to me, we have other priorities, and I don't know the big picture.
Picture? Michael, can I just interject for a second with what you just said in regards to the people that were putting drugs into the bodies of the dead GIs? we actually have, there's somebody that's part of the group that's attacking us. We're being attacked by counterintelligence agents that are FBI and CIA. And one of the guys, one of the main guys that's attacking us, he's been noted to be somebody who was part of Vietnam, working in Vietnam and doing these kind of things, like stuffing drugs into the bodies of dead soldiers. So,
yeah, well, I've heard so many people say tell different stories, and I spent most of my life, you know, investigating what people say, and unfortunately for people who are on the right side and really want truth, people who are engaged in the search for truth, there are just too many frauds out there. You know, I did an interview for a British film company. I just forget the name of it, but it was a film based on interviews of people who lie for a living. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as an undercover agent, one of the things I said on screen was, you know, it's not a lie. I'm playing a role. And I'm playing a role as a weapon. It's just quite different. But what they told me off screen was really fascinating to me. They said that they found that 90% of the men who said they were Vietnam veterans were lying. Now, I don't understand why that happens, but I later, you know, through life, I found that to be true about CIA, DEA, FBI. There's just a lot of people who, and how would you know? You know, it's kind of like when you go on the internet when the Big White Lie, first of all, the Big White Lie was published a number of years ago. That came from my when DEA transferred me as country attaché to Buenos Aires, Argentina, and I was living in South America and working deep cover cases. Well, when I wrote the Big White Lie, because I couldn't believe what was happening, and it's based on tape recorded conversations. You know, I was very conscious of people saying things and not really being able to prove it. And I wanted to be able to prove to America that everything I said is impeccable truth, backed up, documented. Of course, if you go on YouTube now, I put the video up myself. There's Judge Bonner, who was the head of DEA, Federal Judge Bonner. And he, long after the Big White Lie was written and we got involved in another case where Central Intelligence was actually caught smuggling, Judge Bonner looked at the cameras in 60 Minutes. I was on the same show, and he said, CIA are drug smugglers. What better proof do you need? I wish he had come out or somebody had come out back when I wrote the Big White Lie. There wouldn't have been a question. But what makes it difficult to believe for people is that there are so many charlatans out there, you know, people who muddy the water. And now the internet kind of makes it worse.
Michael, I have a question for you. Are you familiar with the former FBI agent? He's deceased now, but his name was Ted Gunderson. Were you familiar with him?
Very familiar. I did a couple of interviews with Ted on my own radio show in New York. And, know him well. I didn't know he died, but,
Before Ted Gunderson, before Ted Gunderson died, before he died, I mean, what do you know about him as much as, like, could you tell us, like, what you know about him? Because we can tell you what we know about him.
Well, the only thing I could vouch, look, he was a real FBI agent, which I verified before I put him on the air. Other than that, there's nothing that I could from my position, you know, as being a civilian, more or less, to investigate and really vet them. You know, it's kind of like when you have these blogs now and you have people who say, I'm with CIA and I've been trained by CIA, I'm an assassin, I'm this, I'm that, I'm the other thing. And the fact is, you know, they're sitting at the computer. For all I know, they're sitting in their mother's basement in their underwear, you know, eating pizza pie, just banging away on a computer. I mean, they could be legitimate, but you can't tell. I understand that a lot of them are probably not. All of this became really serious to me when, you know, I wrote my books. I wrote Deep Cover. I wrote The Big White Lie. Everything was documented. You know, it's absolute They described absolute treason.
Michael, yeah. I did check you out, and I do know that, you know, you are somebody that's done all the things that you're saying you've done as far as, like, all the research. I haven't really done it thoroughly, but from what I can see, and I have a pretty good judge of character. Now, Mr. Ted Gunderson, the FBI agent, he started working under J. Edgar Hoover, and they started something called counterintelligence propaganda. Are you familiar with that?
COINTELPRO.
Exactly.
COINTELPRO. And I had another guy on who came out and really blew the whistle on COINTELPRO setting up Geronimo Pratt for a murder he never committed. FBI, a whole crew of FBI agents did that. His name is Wes Swearingen. I don't know if Wes is still alive or not, but his interview was mind-blowing, and he was the real thing. I mean, you know, his testimony got this Black Panther out of jail. He wasn't even in the same state when this woman was killed, and they had a crew of FBI working to frame the man, and they did it, and Wes Swearingen got on the air, and he talked about how they had a big celebration when the man was convicted.
You that Mr. Ted Gunderson was COINTELPRO until the day he died. Mr. Gunderson was actually working with a really bad group of guys. The one guy I mentioned that was talking about the stuffing the bodies in Vietnam, he worked directly under Ted Gunderson. And Ted Gunderson organized a group of guys to come and attack Dr. Horowitz, who's also co-hosting the show right now. He's here now. And what they did was, see, Dr. Horowitz was at the forefront of exposing the deadliness of vaccinations. So he's really putting a damper in the pharmaceutical companies. And he was also cited by Jeremiah Wright, who was Obama's minister during Obama's election, about one of Miss Dr. Horowitz's books, which was Emerging Viruses. And it talked about how AIDS was created in a laboratory in New York and how it was administered through hepatitis B vaccination trials to gay men in New York and to Black people in Africa and also to people in San Francisco. So that's how the AIDS virus was spread. And Dr. Horowitz had all the document evidence. He put it into his book. And Jeremiah Wright, Obama's pastor, said, "Have you not read Horowitz's book?" And he was attacked by this group of guys. And not only that, but he's also promoting peace, like the 528 Love Revolution, which is something that John Lennon did, was promote peace. And they organized a group, I mean, a very organized group, but a lot of low-life thugs on get-out-of-jail-card-free type thugs. And they came after Dr. Horowitz. And we right now are in a lawsuit against, because Gunderson's not alive, so we can't add him to it, but all of his boys are part of our legal complaint. And it is so telling and so amazing how we put all the evidence together, everything, the documented evidence. Now, these guys are also involved with KKK, white supremacy, and they attacked us. They call us all kinds of names because we're Jewish. And
it's all, the whole thing is a matter of dividing the people, manipulating the people, because that's where the money is. Essentially,
it's dangerous in this country, in this world, to fight for truth. A search for truth is really dangerous. And you're finding it out. I found it out, throughout my life. You know, believing that, my father, who was not a nice guy, used to say, "You know what hell is, son? Hell is being the only man trying to play straight in a dirty card game." And here you are. Do you follow me? Here you are. I found myself. I wasn't the only man, but there were just a very few of us just trying to play straight. And you can't do that. Not in this world. You cannot. Sadly, unfortunately, you can't. So what else could I do but sit down and take the skills that I had learned from the government, that is to document things, to wear microphones, and put it all together in books in an unimpeachable way and say, "Here, America, this is what you pay $1 trillion for. You have paid $1 trillion for a war on drugs right now, and I'm going to show you exactly how you've been defrauded." And that's what the big white lie was. The what got me crazy about The Big White Lie and why I put it out now in an iBook was that just a few months ago, my phone started ringing off the hook. And people from DEA were calling me, and they said, take a look, go online, look at Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia. And sure enough, Evo Morales is he's all over the internet, and he's holding up the Spanish translation of The Big White Lie called La Guerra Sucia, the phony war in Spanish. And he's saying, this is why I kicked DEA out of my country. He kicked DEA out of his country, you know, holding up basically the Big White Lie and saying, and what got me crazy about it was, what really happened, it should have motivated him to boot Central Intelligence out of his country and welcome back DEA, at least for that period of time in his history. We were the heroes. We were working with the Bolivian government against Central Intelligence. The only thing is, we the DEA agents, didn't even know it. We didn't know we were fighting CIA. We thought we were fighting ex-Nazis like Klaus Barbie. We thought we were fighting paramilitaries from all over Europe who'd come in to work for the narco kings. And we won, only nobody knows it. We actually won. And then that victory was taken away from us by Central Intelligence. And that's the story of The Big White Lie. Sonia Atala, this incredibly beautiful woman who Pablo Escobar called the Queen of Cocaine, was the Queen Supreme. She outsmarted CIA. She outsmarted the Drug Enforcement Administration. And she outsmarted the cartels. And for all, I don't know what her position is in life now. I know they were hiding her after the book was written. And it's just an astounding story that America has to read to understand how Central Intelligence betrayed us all. Central Intelligence aided the drug traffickers for the first time in the history of the world to take over a country at a time when the crack cocaine was first developing, and a unified General Motors of cocaine had to be created to meet and increase the demand of cocaine in the U.S., and Central Intelligence did it. And the proof is there in the pages of The Big White Lie. It's there. But now it's up to America to do something about it.
What's the Bush's connection? What's the Bush family's connection to it, Michael?
Well, what the way it worked is this. It was Roberto Suarez. Roberto Suarez was called before Roberto Suarez, the Gasser family, the Mafia Cruceña, that was the Santa Cruz Mafia. At this time in our history, they were controlling 90% of the cocaine that you got on the Earth's surface. Bolivia was just a big cocaine factory. The people producing the raw material, Colombia was just a factory for cocaine producing, but they were getting all their raw materials from Bolivia and Roberto Suarez and the Mafia Cruceña. DEA didn't even know Roberto Suarez existed. I was stationed in Argentina, and the drug traffickers used to call me El Judío Trigueño, the dark Jew, or they called me El Tiburón, the shark. I know why they called me the dark Jew, because I am a dark Jew, but they started calling me the shark also.
And they call us not Hebrew Khazars right now.
Khazars.
Edomites. Spawns of Satan.
they say that we're trying to take out the world. We're with the Illuminati Jewish people that are trying to take out the world.
Yeah, I love that Illuminati. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to change my name in my next life to Mike Illuminati.
So go ahead, continue. Where's the connection to Bush family?
So there was none that I could see at that time. Bush. I met George Bush when George Bush was the vice president. I was running the Miami airport, and I met George Bush. I don't think a president of the United States really ran this country yet. The guy whose fingerprints are all over the place are Ali North, you go, Ali North, if you go out in the, go online and Google, I volunteer to kidnap Ali North. That's an article I wrote that was published pretty widely and I heard was distributed all over Virginia at the time he was running for senator. And I hope it was part of what helped defeat him. But, yeah, Ali North is in The Big White Lie. But the story begins.
George Bush Sr. Was head of the CIA, so that's really what we were wondering, like, what was his connection there, the father Bush, Sr. Bush, because he seems to be one of the most evilest men to ever, like, walk the surface of the planet.
By name, I can't say, George Bush had anything to do with this particular case, but CIA did. What happened in this particular case was a deep cover case. I was again posing as a half Puerto Rican, half Sicilian mafioso in South America, making drug connections. At that time in our history, the biggest cocaine seizure was 200 kilos of cocaine. Nobody even took cocaine seriously. In fact, DEA, some of the top bosses in DEA called it kiddie dope. And here I am in South America, and I'm meeting people from Bolivia with informers who are telling me that they're about to take over their country. They're telling me that they're looking for customers to get rid of the Colombians. The Colombians they considered animals. They were looking to deal directly to the U.S. rather than through Colombia. And for a while, I represented a chance for them to deal directly with the American mafia. That's what they thought was happening, and that was their Achilles heel. And I began dealing with Roberto Suarez. I began dealing with Marcelo Ibanez, who was the Minister of Agriculture for Bolivia, and he was Roberto Suarez's right-hand man. And we made a one-ton deal for cocaine. At that time, it was the biggest drug deal, undercover deal in history, blah, blah, blah. You've heard that over and over, but this was for real. And at a time when Suarez wasn't even in the DEA computer, and that ended in Miami. It was a very exotic case. Penthouse magazine called it the Great Cocaine Sting, called it one of the greatest undercover sting operations in history, and it was pretty wild. I don't know if it was the greatest in history, but it was a wild case.
Did they speak about including it in a James Bond movie?
Yeah, well, it was kind of, I sort of felt like I was, I believed myself to be, living this kind of James. As a matter of fact, the reason I went and became undercover narcotic agent was I flash back to I'm in college. I'm married. I have two kids. I have one boy at that point, and I'm graduating Hofstra University with a degree in accounting. And the only thing I knew at the time I was graduating was that I hated accounting. I just couldn't do that. I thought I would have to get a tattoo on my right and left hand to distinguish what debit and credit was. And I listened to an all-night, I started listening to these all-night radio shows, and there was a writer on, and he was talking about who in the U.S. government really lives the James Bond life, what sends you into that kind of a rarefied atmosphere. And he said, federal narcotic agencies, they travel the world, they work undercover, they use false, they are the only ones. CIA really doesn't get out of the office. They hire informers to be the agents. I interviewed Bob Baird, who is the basis of Syriana, who in his book and on the show admitted, he says, Central Intelligence, most of them aren't allowed to go out of the office. They have their agents who are paid informers go out. So that's what I wanted to be. I had a few years earlier, I was military policeman, and I had gotten into a fight with a guy, a fellow military policeman, and in a half a second, he pulled his gun, stuck it in my stomach, and pulled the trigger, and it misfired. This, by the way, is all in the book Undercover. It misfired, and that moment, there's an old Arab expression, any moment is the right moment to die. And I learned it. I learned that firsthand, 19 years old. And so I was in a rush. I was in a rush to experience everything you could. So basically, I started off just on this desire to live this exciting world, globe-trotting life. And I was really a poor Jewish kid from the Bronx with no money, and but a good talent, a strange talent for posing as things, acting, and that's what I became. It was a couple of years later that we found out that my brother David was a heroin addict, and I became this kamikaze, you know, drug agent. But here I am in South America, you know, living this James Bond life, thinking I'm living this James Bond life, but also believing that my country was still was on the right side of was on the good side, that I was on the good side, that I was representing, that I was risking my life for good, honest people. I had buried what happened in Bangkok. I had just totally buried it. And this undercover case ends in a Kendall bank vault in Florida, just outside of Miami, and with me paying $8 million for what evolved into 1,000 pounds of cocaine, which was the biggest seizure at that time. That was on a plane flying back to the U.S., and the pilots contacted me by radio, and they said, okay, to pay the money now. And I meet with a man by the name of Jose Roberto Gasser. Now, the Gasser family goes back to the World Anti-Communist League. They were tied to Central Intelligence for many, many years before, you know, I was meeting Jose Roberto Gasser in this bank vault, along with another man, Alfredo Cutucci Gutierrez, who was an airplane broker and a high-ranking member of the Mafia Cruceña. And I pay them $8 million, and this is all videotaped. And they leave the bank. The drugs are coming into the U.S. They're busted. Before I could get on a plane back to Argentina, they were released. All charges dropped. Who released them? Pat Sullivan, who was ironically the prosecutor who put Manuel Noriega, and you'll see in The Big White Lie is a great big picture of Pat Sullivan. I was astounded. I couldn't understand why this is $8 million in drug money, the biggest case in our history, and he let them go. It gets worse. The two of them go back, Contracts for My Life. I have cables, and the cables are in the book, where money is being offered to hitmen all over South America to kill El Judio Trigueño, the dark Jew in Argentina. And doesn't stop there. They begin to foment a revolution to kill and take away the government from the people who secretly worked with us. That is the Lydia Gaylor government, who the CIA considered the leftist government. And that revolution happened on July 17th, 1980. The very people, the Bolivians, who worked closely with DEA to overcome the CIA-sponsored, protected revolution. You just picture this. You have CIA assets working with Klaus Barbie, escaped Nazis, paramilitaries from all over Europe, to kill the people who rightfully elected to lead the Bolivian government, the people who really wanted to get rid of the drug dealers, and that was how they were paid. That's why when Evo Morales booted DEA, I wrote an article saying, you know, if you really, and I know Evo, I've met Evo Morales, said if you really know, if you read the book, he wouldn't be booting DEA. Direct a statute for them. They were working with your people. It was Central Intelligence who did this. And first thing I did, and it's in the book, was I wrote a letter to Newsweek magazine to the two people who were writing, allegedly following the Bolivian, Larry Roeder and Steven Strasser, two journalists. And I wrote it, return receipt requested. They had written a huge article about the drug war and our case, and they just totally left out that the main people, the people running the whole cocaine into the U.S. had been released from jail and fomented the revolution, and they had done it with America, with Central Intelligence, with U.S. money behind them. At the same time, you had U.S. money be spending millions to create this amazing sting operation. So you had the U.S. taxpayer paying both ends of this. Now, you would think the story would end there, but when I got the return receipt requested, the next thing that happens is I am put under investigation. The journalists never contacted me. I have proof that Newsweek received my letter, but I'm put under an investigation that lasts for the next 3 years, and every part of my life is just torn apart. I'm sent up from Argentina to the U.S. Contracts are on my life. I'm under investigation, and now I'm sitting there in DEA headquarters, in a little room with no windows, wondering how I'm going to keep from blowing myself away. I was just completely morally destroyed, and I had no idea what was going to happen with my life. My marriage was just gone to crap. At that point, I had a daughter who was becoming a cocaine addict, and by that time, my brother David. Pardon me. My brother David had committed suicide after 19 years of heroin addiction. And he wrote a letter saying, you know, I just can't stand the drugs anymore. And that was it. I lost my brother. So what allegiance do I turn to? Who do I turn to? I was completely lost in this world. And one of the senior agents comes to my office and he said, come on upstairs. You may have an undercover assignment, and I can't believe this. And when I get upstairs to this office, there is this amazingly beautiful woman just sitting there. And there are all the top people in DEA and people who I don't recognize, maybe six or seven men in suits, and her. And she starts to speak to me in Spanish. And she starts asking me questions, and, you know, I'm answering, and I'm still kind of, she kind of looked like Selma Hayek. I don't know, I guess a cross between Selma Hayek and Penelope, if you can picture this, Penelope Cruz. Her photo is in the Big White Lie, but I had to block her face out, or they put me in jail even now, I suppose.
Is that who we're talking about now?
Hello?
Is that who we're talking about, Sonia Atala now?
Yeah, Sonia Atala. Sonia Atala. And after she talks to me for a few minutes, I'd say about 20 minutes or so, she tells somebody, I'll do. You know, I was passing some sort of an audition and didn't know it. And then I'm asked if I'll do the assignment. And the assignment is that I am to, that for, I'm told that, that it's revealed who she is. She was the top sales. What else could you call her? She was a sales representative for the Bolivian cocaine industry. She was selling cocaine all over the world.
Who was she working for?
She was working for the Bolivian government. The Bolivian government at that point, the Bolivian government that had been put into power by Central Intelligence, our Central Intelligence, was now the main purveyor of cocaine for the world. They had an organization that became, it was La Mafia Cruceña, the Santa Cruz Mafia, became what they call La Corporación, the corporation. And the corporation was literally the General Motors of cocaine at that time. And she was the prime salesperson. And what was amazing about Sonia is, as beautiful as she was, she never had, she never used sex to get, she was just respected. She was a queen. She had the ability, this God-given ability to kind of control situations, to command, to domineer very easily and so skillfully and artfully done that I could see right away how this woman went so far. She was not only beautiful, she was super bright and very, very quick. And what I'm told at this point is that she had a contract dispute with a Colombian cartel leader by the name of Papo Mejia. She was supposed to deliver a large amount of cocaine. He gave her, as a down payment, $1 million for this large amount of cocaine base, which he would turn into cocaine and import to Miami, to the U.S. The only thing is the Bolivian government at that point wanted to get rid of Sonia. They wanted her out. She had become too powerful. So what they did, rather than just kill her because her family had some connections in Bolivia, what they did is simply not deliver the cocaine to Mejia and leave it up to Mejia. Well, she couldn't get the Bolivian government to deliver, and Mejia was not a guy. Mejia was a maniac. He was a mad dog killer, and he had no patience, and he immediately sent out killers to kill Sonia and her family. She had a husband who had been a race car driver, a one-time candidate for president of Bolivia, and three kids, and they were all going to die. All she could do was turn to DEA to help her. Now, at this point, I wasn't thinking that, I couldn't imagine that this woman was a CIA asset. It was the last thing in the world I could imagine. I understood her turning to DEA as an undercover informant, and they whisked her out of the country and into a house in Virginia, and this is where I meet her. Now, my role was to be her lover, her business partner, and I was going to assume her debt with Mejia. And we were going to use that role to gather evidence and prove a conspiracy against the whole Bolivian government. And it was called they called it the cocaine government, and the Minister of Interior was called the Minister of Cocaine, Luis Arce Gomez. And you could Google all these names. You'll see.
I have a question for you. We have about 5 minutes left of the show, but I have a question. Have you ever thought about turning your book into a screenplay?
Well, Robert De Niro actually optioned The Big White Lie. And, you know, my wife and I met him, and my wife is film trained, and she kind of went crazy. But they never were able to make it. It's been optioned several times. But De Niro had the option for about 3 years. And the game in Hollywood is he doesn't spend his money. He wants to get money. He has to get money from other investors to finance the movie. And being in those years, attacking the CIA in a movie was not very popular. It became a lot more accepted years later. So who knows? I mean, they might pick it up again now.
Right. You may want to try to approach Leonardo DiCaprio or someone like that who's, you know, really on a roll right now, making a lot of popular movies, because it does sound like something that could be a popular film. I mean,
this would be a perfect role for DiCaprio.
Sounds like a real. Yeah. I mean, it sounds DiCaprio, like something that Hollywood would really go for.
Yeah, I don't know why I envision Selma Hayek because they just look like her. I mean, they just absolutely look like Sonia. And what happens? We put it out for $2.99 in iBook because I once said if I could, I would give it to every American to read. So the closest I could do is putting it out for $2.99 as an iBook. But when you read it, those of you who do read it, just imagine when you're reading this complete treasonous act by Central Intelligence. One of the things that's really important, Sonia was telling me about something called pichicata when we were living together. She was telling me something about something called pichicata. People were smoking coca base in Bolivia, and she said, this is going to be in the States soon. And there you had crack cocaine. I wrote it up. There was a DEA report. But it was the harbinger of crack cocaine.
I have another question for you. This is a personal question. Did you really actually have the affair with Sonia, or was it just
you know, Sherry, here's what's going to happen. I mean, if I say I did not, and you read the book, you're going to say, yeah, Levine's a liar. If I say I did, they're going to come and try to put me in jail right now even. So you basically got to, decide for yourself.
I mean, I'm sure a lot of people will be curious about that, just to know, because, she had another life, and then she had this secret life with you. And so, one has to wonder, really, if...
Well, you got to wonder about it. Could you think it would have been superhuman, I think, to perform with Internal Affairs working on me. They sent in a Frances Johnson, a Puerto Rican agent. She was supposed to be my sister and chaperone us. And then DEA kept taking her out of the house. It's all in the book, and leaving me alone with her. And then having me fly with her here and there. And at one point, I'm with Sonia in Virginia. I just dropped. We got off a plane from Arizona, and I drop her off, and I see I'm being followed, and I'm sure it's Internal Affairs, and I came here from killing them. Again, you got to read it in the book, and I'm glad I didn't. But my guy, was one of the sickest moments of my life, where I was just desperate and crazed and really dangerous. And usually I'm not. I'm very controlled. But in this particular moment, I lost it. And
so you have no idea where she is today? No idea?
I have no idea where she is now. None. People have come looking for her, contacting me, looking for her. And I have no idea.
Well, give everybody your website and where they can contact you. I know you have another company as well. You do detective work or private investigations?
No, I'm a trial consultant. I'm an expert witness. I testify. I'm actually working for the State Department right now, teaching undercover tactics and informant handling to right now the Brazilian Federal Police. My main gig is trial consultant and an expert witness in covert actions, informant handling, police use of force. I spend a lot of time in court now.
Wow. So you do get a lot of people needing that type of business. Can you give everybody your website for that? And also,
Michael Levine Books is one. .com. That's a brand new website. Michael Levine, and you don't forget to use the two L's. And then my professional site as an expert witness and trial consultant is policetrialexpert.com. That's one word, policetrialexpert.com. And last is the New York radio show, expertwitnessradio.org. But just go on. I've just put a YouTube video up called Death Trap. It's one of the undercover videos of me working undercover where I was set up to be killed. And they actually got the two guys who had set me up. It's all caught on video.
Wow. And can you spell your name so everybody who doesn't know how to spell your name? Because I know sometimes people spell it without the E on the end. So
that's Levin in the Bronx. That's Levin. Actually, the funny thing, I was in school with a guy who spoke his name Levine, exactly like mine. He was in college, and his name was Barry Levine, and I was Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, Levine, Levine, just like his. And the teacher used to go down the list and say, Barry Levine, Michael Levine.
Yeah. Because it's just how you pronounce the vowel on it,
Yeah. So. Well, when I was living in South America, I was Levine. Levine.
Well,
déjeme hablar con la gente de habla hispana. Tus oyentes.
Okay, so it's L-E-V-I-N-E, folks. It's Michael L-E-V-I-N-E. That's the person that we are interviewing today. And thank you so much, Michael, for being on our show.
Thank you, Michael.
It was really great. It was like you just really spoke of film right there. I mean, it was your real life, but it definitely not everybody lives like that every day. And so it's very interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. This is fun. And you two are really likable, and I'm glad to have done it.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Well,
bye.
Folks, that does it for another Insight Hour. I'm Dr. Len Horowitz. Join us again next
Tuesday night, midnight on the East Coast and 9 o'clock Pacific, and tell everybody if you want to learn about COINTELPRO right now, the best place to do it is online at waronwethepeople.com, and that's also where you can get kind of like the latest information on what Sherry and I have been up to in the world of taking on the global beast through the justice system that we're finding. You know what? Maybe we can achieve some justice in the justice system.
That's why we're taking it to you, yeah, the people.
So we're taking it both. We're taking it to the court of public, decisions, and also to the
circuit court and to the federal court.
Yeah, right. So anyway, well, join us again, and also register for our newsletter at healthyworldstore.com, because we will be putting out very soon another newsletter to bring you up to date on what's happening. Thanks a lot.
Good night.
God
bless.